Okay, well, maybe we should get started. It's just after 11 here. Hi, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to our second Hellraiser briefing call with co-editor Clara Jeffrey and reporter Kate Shepard, who, by the way, should really be on her honeymoon right now, but she's that dedicated to Mother Jones and joined us today. So thank you, Kate, and congratulations again. My name is Lauren Asdell, and I am the Director of Development here at Mother Jones. I will also be moderating today's call. Today, we will be discussing what's known as the GOP's war on women. Clara and Kate will touch upon the latest political attacks to Mother Jones's groundbreaking coverage to the implications for this strategy heading into the November election. We do these briefings to give you an inside look behind the scenes of Mother Jones. Our journalists are busy in San Francisco, D.C. and New York, covering the latest breaking news, or in the field working on deep dive investigations. While the end result is award-winning journalism you've come to know, love, and support, as a reader, you often don't get to hear the story behind the story. How do we get the lead? What did it take to break the story before anyone else? How do we ensure our reporting will have the greatest impact? We will discuss all of this and more on today's call, but before we begin, I want to remind you of a few housekeeping items. Clara and Kate will begin the discussion. Many of you who are on the call are passionate about this issue, so we welcome and encourage questions at any time throughout the briefing, but we'll reserve some time at the end for a Q&A. All callers are muted on the call, so if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 9 on your phone. When you've been unmuted, you will hear a prompt that you've been released to speak, and I'll ask you to introduce yourselves. Once Clara or Kate has answered your question, you will again be remuted. Please keep your questions concise, and please avoid using speakerphone if possible. If we don't get to your question during the call today, you will have an opportunity to ask a question of Kate or Clara after the call via email. So that is it for housekeeping. I'd like to hand it over to Clara Jeffrey and Kate Shepard. Take it away.
Hi, this is Clara Jeffrey. I'm co-editor of Mother Jones. I've met many of you before, and I'm excited to give you guys a sort of behind-the-scenes look at one of our key reporting areas, which is the ongoing GOP war on women and reproductive rights and human rights as it pertains to women specifically in general. And so I'm just going to ask Kate a few questions to get things going. Kate, as you all know, kind of has a dual beat. She is one of our key environmental reporters and has been doing environmental coverage for years, both at Mother Jones and before that at Grist. But in the last, I'd say about two and a half years, she's also really carved out a great area of coverage for us with reproductive rights. So, Kate, I was in D.C. just a few weeks ago, and I remember clearly that Bureau Chief David Korn was joking that we were covering the GOP's war on women before the war on women was cool. And in large part, that's due to your reporting. Since we're among friends here, I thought you could just mention a story or two that you broke.
Sure. Well, it's actually been a really interesting thing for me to move to this beat because I think on the environment I covered it for so long that I kind of stopped being shocked by things, but the war on women continues to shock me, like the new stories all the time. I mean, one I wrote about this morning, just today, is Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky is trying to attach an amendment to the National Flood Insurance Plan legislation that would basically force senators to vote on the question of when life begins as part of the flood insurance program package, which, you know, obviously it has absolutely nothing to do with it. This is just sort of yet another attempt to sort of basically make a fertilized egg an adult equal to an adult woman and put that into legislation sort of via any means possible.
I think what was interesting about that one, right, is that flood insurance was one of the very few pieces of legislation that Congress was expected to pass, and I'm sure now that will not happen unless he removes that amendment.
Yeah, unless he stops trying. It's absolutely, it was one of the sort of key pieces of bipartisan agreement, and as everyone knows, hurricane season just started, and there's 5.6 million properties in the U.S. that are relying upon this program, and it expires at the end of July, but that doesn't matter. I mean, they're sort of willing to, like, let this bipartisan bill die in order to give personhood rights to a fetus.
Can you talk a little bit more about the personhood concept? Because, you know, although the concept, I guess, has obviously been around as long as the pro-life movement, it's been a real tactic, it seems, in the last year or so to kind of inject this idea into legislation in kind of new and interesting ways.
Yeah, well, absolutely. This is the principle of behind these measures is to sort of write into law through a variety of different measures, either through constitution or through the criminal code or through, you know, different states have tried different tactics, but basically to write into law that a human life begins at conception. So as soon as a sperm meets an egg, that has exactly the same rights as an adult human. And so we saw this a few years ago in Colorado and it failed, but they made a comeback last year with a ballot initiative in Mississippi that also failed, which actually it was quite surprising by actually how much it failed, considering that Mississippi is one of the least friendly states when it comes to women's rights. So it failed in Mississippi, but that still hasn't deterred them. It's been introduced in a number of states around the country. It's, you know, come up in Georgia and Utah, and I think it's looking forward to sort of introducing it in Oklahoma as well. And so they've really just sort of use this as one of the new ways to make it impossible for a woman to get an abortion, or even to use a lot of kinds of birth control. It basically would outlaw several specific kinds of birth control, likely IUDs, the morning after pill, because, you know, that would say that, you know, even if a fertilized egg could potentially be harmed by birth control, a woman couldn't use it. And so this is something that's increasingly more popular.
Right. And I'm just going to remind folks quickly that if they want to raise their hand and ask a question, you basically do that by dialing *9. I think what kind of shocked a lot of electoral watchers was that that connection that you just mentioned, that, you know, there's obviously a lot of people who feel passionately, their opposition against abortion is passionate, but that has sort of morphed in some ways into an anti-contraception movement that that there's a lot less support for, and that seems a lot more dangerous for the GOP to sort of raise as an issue. Could you speak a little bit about that?
Right, exactly. So these personhood amendments do raise that question. You know, so if life begins at conception, would that outlaw specific kinds of birth control, which is an area where, you know, a lot of Americans really do care about access to contraception. They don't want legislators meddling in, their own reproductive health decisions, particularly when it comes to contraception. And that's actually one of the reasons that it failed in Mississippi last year, is because, you know, it drew a lot of outcry from women's groups and moms groups, because it also probably would have, created some real legal questions around in vitro fertilization and other fertilization treatments as well. And so they saw a lot of uprising from people who just said, you know, this is really stepping over the bounds into, you know, personal lives of women and families. In a way that, you know, other bills hadn't before. And so there was a really unified outcry about that. And I think that's been really clear. What's been clear sort of in the wake of that personhood measure and others around the country is that this basically just sort of reveals what a lot of these lawmakers who want to pass anti-abortion legislation are really after. You know, it's not just about abortion. It's about limiting women's healthcare rights and access more broadly. And so I think those efforts really sort of unmasked that for what it was, and showed that, and this is really about sort of greater control of women's reproductive rights and healthcare.
And sexuality, I think we should say. I see that we have a hand raised, so I'm just going to say that, and someone's going to unmute somebody, I believe.
Oh, I think that was me. Diane Filippi, hi.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, everybody. My God, that's really a great story, Kate. I have just a question. When we find out about stories like that, do you get the word out to NARAL and to all the nonprofits that really go head on with those, the legislation and so forth? I mean, do we ever do that?
I think what generally happens, and maybe we can come back to that with another story that Kate broke, the sort of story that that she and Nick did on the GOP trying to redefine rape. And we reported that story, and it was picked up by the activist groups, starting with a Dear John for John Boehner campaign on Twitter, and then ultimately in kind of every women's right and progressive group as a campaign. And I think that's more generally how our journalism is translated to the activist community. Kate, would you say that that's true?
Yeah, and usually what we see happen is, you know, our story gets out there. You know, we obviously publish it on the website, but then we're tweeting it out, and it gets picked up pretty quickly.
It gets picked up. That's natural. Really my question. Yeah,
yeah,
because then
more
they will
get
pickup.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly a few years ago.
I mean, this thing in Kentucky, I mean, the guy just has to, the flood insurance issue is really just amazing.
Right. And I think the other thing that we do as a sort of public affairs side of things is that we obviously, when we have, especially, you know, when Nick and Kate kind of unmasked again and again the GOP's attempts to redefine rape, and Kate, I'll just get you to explain a little bit more in a second, but, you know, we obviously sent out a lot of press releases on that to, amongst others, those groups. So there's a pretty natural pipeline.
Good.
Of that.
Okay.
Kind of information.
Thank you.
Kate, can you kind of tell us a little bit more about that story and the sort of when you guys first discovered it and then the sort of various iterations of how exactly the House was trying to redefine rape?
Sure. About a little more than a year ago, the House Republicans were working on this bill, the No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act, that, you know, was supposed to write into law once again that taxpayer dollars shouldn't be used for abortion. And this is something that's been written into law for, you know, decades now through the Hyde Amendment, which says that federal funds can't be spent on abortions. But, you know, Republicans have felt the need that we need to clarify that once again through legislation. But in this bill that they introduced last year, they actually went into the language of how we, generally the Hyde Amendment has an exception for rape, incest, and if the life of the mother is at risk. And in those cases, you know, it says that federal funds can be used for abortion. Whether that's through, you know, sort of health programs like Medicaid or through funding at clinics that offer those services. And so they went into the bill and they actually rewrote what it meant to be raped and rewrote that exception to say that it only included forcible rape. So, you know, there are a lot of open legal questions about what that even means. What does forcible rape mean? Who says, who decides what's forcible rape? It's not even, there's no criminal code that defines what that means. But essentially, it would have left off a lot of women who, you know, either were victims of statutory rape, who were maybe drugged or you know, sort of intoxicated when they were raped.
Right,
would have written out date rape.
Yeah.
Right, people in hospitals. And so, it would have really created this sort of awful situation in which, you know, women who are raped, but, you know, someone decides it's not forcible, are made to pay for their own abortions. And this was written into law. And we, Nick really was the one who dug this out. And so this is by virtue of the fact that we do have a number of really good contacts around Washington and around the country who are watching this stuff and sort of can point that out to us when that kind of thing crops up in legislation. And we pay really close attention to the Federal Register to see what kind of bills are coming through. And so we were able to dig that out and highlight it. And it really did spur a pretty large activist campaign against that measure. And eventually Republicans had to pull it out because of that outrage. They tried again to insert it later, but, you know, the outrage, we again highlighted it and it was taken out of the bill eventually.
And for those of you on the call who, you know, are perhaps not quite as Twitter addicted as Kate and myself, it really was an incredible groundswell of activism around these series of stories that just, you know, not only lit up the kind of Twitter sphere, but then translated into various campaigns by NARAL and Move On, I believe, and Emily's List and the like. To that end, Kate, you know, the Credo recently created a national petition in response to your story about how female soldiers don't have access to abortion, you know, which had been State Department policy for a while, but you really brought it into the national debate. How did you come to cover that?
Well, this one, it has absolutely been part of policy since the late 80s. As I noted before, in general, federal policy is guided by the Hyde Amendment, which says that federal funds can't be used for abortions except for the case of rape, incest, and the health of the mother. Well, thanks to Republican efforts many years ago, the Department of Defense actually has an even more strict policy, and women who are in the military can only access abortions using their military authorized medical care if their life is at risk. So women in the military, who are raped, which is a huge problem in the military in and of itself, but if they are raped and they become pregnant, they actually can't use their medical benefits to pay for that abortion, and it should be a pretty huge outcry about this, but it has been in law for quite some time. Jean Shaheen from New Hampshire, Senator, she proposed a measure to change that in the last two sessions of Congress, but this year she actually managed to get it in the defense authorization bill in committee, which greatly increases its chances of passing in the Senate. She actually has the support of John McCain, who's the ranking Republican member on that committee. She has the support of leadership in the Senate, and so it most likely will pass the Senate. But Republicans in the House have already said that they're going to block that, and so we have been following that campaign because there are a number of service members who are out there sort of leading the effort to get this passed, and a bunch of reproductive rights groups have been really pushing to get this passed. So, you know, we were able to cover it because we had sort of good relationships with people who are doing that work and know the people who are working on it in Congress, and sort of were able to dig in a little bit of the fact that House Republicans are still blocking this when it should be something that, you know, is pretty self-evident that women deserve that right to that access for that health care.
I mean, it's especially egregious when you consider that I believe female soldiers serving in Afghanistan and Iraq have been more likely to be raped by their own fellow soldiers and killed by enemy fire. So while that's certainly not the only reason that might prompt a servicewoman to seek an abortion, it could very well be one. I'm just going to remind people again that if you want to raise your hand and ask a question, that you push *9, and that's the way to speak up and ask a question of Kate or myself. Kate, you know, another thing that has been sort of a part of this attack on war on women is, the sort of failure to yet again kind of pass a measure to put some kind of legal assurances for pay equity. Do you see things like reproductive rights, the pay equity movement, access to, Head Start and those kind of educational entitlement programs that pertain to women and children, do you see that kind of coming together as an effective political point to be made about the GOP? Is that congealing in voters' minds, do you think, outside of the kind of progressive activist community?
Well, I think what I've seen is, the last, and not just 2008 and 2010 elections, people were looking, they're thinking about the economy, they're thinking about jobs. And so that was really what drove a lot of the electoral decisions in those years for women and men alike. The economy and jobs has been sort of what's been driving a lot of people's political decisions here in the U.S., for good reason. And a lot of the legislators who were voted in, many of them Republicans in 2008 and 2010, they came in with this like sort of goal, this message that they didn't care about social issues anymore. They were just going to do jobs and just going to do the economy. And I think a lot of people were sort of, more inclined to vote for them for that reason. But, what we've seen and which we've covered extensively is that as soon as they got in office, what did they do? They didn't do anything about jobs. They went right back to the social issues. It was about, women and abortion and gays and minorities and sort of, the same old, same old. And I think you really are seeing people who maybe were sympathetic to their economic messages and jobs messages a few years ago saying, hey, like, this isn't what we elected you to do. Like, we don't want to, this is not what we want. And sort of, I used to hear from people all the time that, they don't want to see this attack at the national level. They don't want this to be the issues that are driving our political conversation right now. They have other things that they care about. And so I think that we really are seeing more people sort of coming back to these issues and saying, look, this is not what we want to see happening. And I think that will be a bigger issue this year.
I mean, there have been some pretty startling poll numbers. I think there was one out of, I believe it was Oregon yesterday, where the gender gap for Romney is just dramatically increasing. I mean, what's interesting is it's increasing in both directions, right? So women are less and less likely to support him in the fine state of Oregon, and while men, I believe, are at least slightly more likely than the last time they took this poll. And that, again, goes to the sort of gender gap issue and the feeling that kind of women, yet again are going to be one of the key electoral swing votes. Does that play into how you see covering these issues? I mean, do they have more resonance because of the political year that we're in?
I think they do have more resonance because, you know, not just because of the types of laws and types of measures we're seeing, but the volume of them. And so I think, you know, sort of people are realizing that, you know, their rights are at stake at both the state level and the federal level. And I think that is driving, you know, more people to sort of pay attention to these issues and to care about them. And I think that will translate into electoral issues since, you know, it's sort of just the repetition that we've seen around the country of these kinds of measures. It's really hard for people to ignore. So how they might be affecting them at you know, in their own personal lives. Another thing I was going to say, I think that another area in which we've seen this sort of really pick up nationally is over this contraceptive fight and the healthcare bill mandate that the Obama administration, you know, asked that, you know, basically required that health insurance companies cover contraception at no cost, which has sort of caused this giant outrage from the right, particularly sort of the religious conservatives. And, you know, I think that one has actually sort of blown up in their face, and that a lot of women do understand that healthcare, that contraception is a basic healthcare, is basic healthcare and should be something that is covered. And sort of are sort of reacting to that and saying, you know, this is something that I want to see through my healthcare.
Right. And, you know, it can't be said often enough that if Viagra is covered, then birth control should be as well. You know, it was interesting as part of that the sort of war on contraception, at least a few months ago, really did seem to kind of startle people, that this was way beyond the you know, pro-life movement and platform I've seen before, that it had seemed to really kind of go straight to the issue of actually, you know, essentially being able to have sex without procreating. And that, you know, in part when Rick Santorum came out pretty strongly against all forms of contraception, I don't know if you remember his exact statement, but basically he was saying that, you know, there should always be the intent of having sex should always be, if not to specifically have children, it should always be a possibility in every single sexual act. And I believe it was Alex Costellos, the GOP strategist, who sort of inveighed against this, saying, you know, this is not a smart move for us. Sex is popular. Like, you can't come out against something that basically would severely limit the ways in which people have sex. Did you see that did startle people, that they were kind of taking this tactic?
No, I think absolutely that it has startled people. You know, it's not just when we're talking about access to contraception via, you know, healthcare programs. It's sort of also in looking around the states, it's sort of different state level attempts to curb sex education and to sort of reinstate sex abstinence only education and to take out talking about contraception and healthy sexuality. We saw that something we covered in Wisconsin was Wisconsin legislature was having this special session on jobs, and what did they do? It was, you know, Governor Walker and his allies in the state house you know, went through and basically again mandated abstinence only education. You know, and they had passed a really progressive bill that actually would have provided comprehensive sex ed in a previous previous session of the state legislature, and then sort of what they did was go in and sort of take that out and make it really bad again. You know, make sure that students, you know, teenagers don't know anything about healthy sexuality. You know, there's another bill in Tennessee that, you know, went through as well that, you know, made it so that schools couldn't even talk about handholding because that was gateway sexuality. You know, this is sort of just all around the country. We're seeing there's sort of these attacks again on contraception and education about contraception and sexuality, which just really does speak to this being about a wider attack on women's rights and education and access.
Can you talk a little bit about the kind of invasive sonogram and other methods used that are kind of sometimes looped directly in with these fetal personhood bills, but often just as a sort of disincentive to anybody seeking an abortion?
Sure. Well, to pull back a little bit, when we look around the country, what we're seeing is sort of a variety of different types of bills that are aimed at sort of chipping away at women's access to abortion. So a lot of the really creative pro-life groups are now not, you know, they're not introducing laws that are a direct take on Roe v. Wade, except for those personhood measures, which are sort of an exception. But a lot of these are bills that sort of would limit access in other ways. And so there are a variety of different methods that they're using, sort of waiting periods. Some of them are 24-hour waiting periods between when a woman goes to her doctor and when she can actually have an abortion. But you know, others are even worse, like South Dakota last year passed the 72-hour waiting period, in which the woman has to wait 72 hours between when she has her first visit with her doctor and when she actually has the abortion, which is, you know, it's really problematic in a state like South Dakota because they have one abortion provider, and it's a huge state where people have to travel many miles to go to see that provider. And so putting the 72-hour barrier in there is really makes it, you know, next to impossible for her to actually have an abortion. And one of the other really popular ways that they're doing this now is through different ultrasound bills. There's several different models that are floating around, but they've become increasingly popular in states. Many of them say that a woman has to go to the doctor. When she goes to her doctor to seek an abortion, she has to have an ultrasound. The doctor has to offer to let her view the ultrasound. They have to offer to let her hear the fetal heartbeat. In some states, they actually require that the doctor gives her a little copy of the photo of her fetus as like a little keepsake to take home. I mean, these are really sort of sick ways that they're trying to like basically torture women who want to have an abortion by sort of, you know, like pretending as if the woman doesn't know what's happening inside her uterus and that she doesn't know that what she's doing is trying to get an abortion. And so, you know, it's really sort of condescending to women who are seeking this access around the country. One of those bills passed earlier this year in Virginia. This one actually ended up drawing a lot of national attention because so reproductive rights groups in the states pointed out that most abortions happen before 12 weeks within 12 weeks of the woman becoming pregnant. And at that point in time, you can't get a really good ultrasound picture, or you can't hear a fetal heartbeat using a regular old sonogram. You actually have to have that. You have to use a transvaginal probe in order to get access to any sort of heartbeat or any sort of actual image of the fetus. And so,
to be blunt, let's just say, like, basically is inserting a large piece of plastic and electronics into you.
Right. In order to have access to a protected, legally, you know, sort of sound healthcare procedure. And so, you know, that actually drew some real outrage when people drew attention to that in Virginia. But, you know, Virginia's wasn't the first time. The same bill had passed in Texas the year before, and it's passed in other states since then. But you know, that one, you know, sort of critics of the law really actually managed to really seize on that and point out how invasive and really, you know, sort of horrifying that measure was.
And, you know, as I recall, too, there were a lot of really heartbreaking stories coming out of, you know, couples who had intended to carry this child to term, but something had gone horribly wrong and were then, you know, not only faced with having to get an abortion when they didn't want to, but being forced to sort of go through all of those ultrasounds and transvaginal ultrasounds and listening to the heartbeat, you know, which is just a sort of another permutation of how insulting and degrading these kind of laws can be.
That's also the case with another sort of classification of laws that are being promoted around the country, which are basically banning abortion at 20 weeks after conception, which, you know, these later term abortions are very rare. They often only happen if there's some really horrible condition that's found with the fetus, or that there's a really horrible condition that, you know, in the woman. And so these are, you know, they're very rare. They're less than 2% of all abortions. But we've seen around the country different states introducing laws to basically make it impossible for women in that state to access an abortion. It passed in Nebraska a year ago, and it's passed in 5 other states. And now they're actually lawmakers in Congress are trying to pass it for D.C. It's a lawmaker from Arizona who's trying to impose it on the District of Columbia because, you know, here we are in D.C., we're a ward of the state whenever it's convenient. And so these 20-week bans are also just sort of really, you know, making it extremely hard for women who are, you know, already faced with really tough decisions about having an abortion, and just making it impossible for them to actually make those decisions between themselves and their physician.
Right. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, kind of in retrospect, we'd been covering the kind of attacks on Planned Parenthood, like going back to the James O'Keefe kind of bogus sting operation, and then to congressional attempts to defund, and then the sort of wrinkle that the Komen story talked about. Can you just remind people how those things kind of interrelated and specifically about the Komen story?
Sure. Well, attacks on Planned Parenthood are not really anything new, but you know, we've seen them really ramp up either through budget fights and attempts to defund them at the federal level, or through this this investigation into Planned Parenthood that Republican House Member Cliff Stearns from Florida launched last fall. Last summer, the anti-abortion group Americans United for Life introduced this, you know, massive paper that they said was, you know, their comprehensive investigation into Planned Parenthood. And just a few weeks later, the House announced that they were going to actually be doing their own investigation into Planned Parenthood as well. So that investigation, you know, it's still ongoing. Nothing's actually come out of it. I mean, people don't seem to think that anything actually will, other than sort of political theater for Republicans who want to make the case that Planned Parenthood is bad and that it shouldn't be funded. But that actually did end up resulting in this sort of issue in February where Susan G. Komen for the Cure, the big breast cancer advocacy research body, announced that they were going to stop funding Planned Parenthood for breast cancer screenings. They gave, you know, a relatively small amount of money to Planned Parenthood clinics so that they could do pre-screening on breast cancer for breast cancer for women, and then give them referrals to have mammograms. So Komen announced that they were no longer funding Planned Parenthood because they're under investigation. Well, they're under investigation because Republicans in Congress basically launched a sort of, you know, totally political investigation into the group based on, you know, a report from pro-lifers. So, you know, this is pretty, like, you know, it was pretty blatantly an excuse for them to stop funding Planned Parenthood for any reason. And there'd been sort of a long-term attack from pro-life groups on Komen for having anything to do with Planned Parenthood. But sort of this was all just kind of another example of attempts to malign and, you know, sort of draw attention to Planned Parenthood and create this impression that there is some sort of negative force that should be you know, defunded. But this is sort of, we've seen that at the federal level, and then we've also seen a number of different state laws that have sought to ban funding to anybody who provides abortions deny family planning funding to anybody who provides abortions. So we've seen measures like that in Indiana and Wisconsin, and there's a lot of them around the country where they've tried to defund Planned Parenthood at the state level now as well.
So before we open it up more broadly to questions, I'd just like you to talk a little bit kind of coming off of that, because it seems like there's sort of two things that journalism does that, you know, straight up activism doesn't, or that you know, the one or the other flow into each other. But and the first is, you know, kind of breaking stories like the redefining rape. And the second is really sort of synthesizing the pattern recognition, like having someone on this beat that can point out there's not just this one bill, but don't forget there's these 20 others. And by the way, there's funding going into these efforts from, you know, this dark money organization over here. Can you just talk a little bit about on a beat like this, where it's, you know, it can be very charged emotionally given the issues that people are dealing with, but you know, that it's a lot of kind of piecemeal attacks. What is the role of a journalist to sort of step back and show people the bigger picture?
No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, we've seen a lot of sort of, there'll be a momentary flare up around a particular piece of legislation. So whether it's the transvaginal ultrasound bill in Virginia, or, you know, a 20-week ban in D.C., what we are able to do is be able to step back and say, give you the context and the history. So, you know, it's really, in the example of Virginia, it's really not just about these, you know, invasive ultrasounds. It's also about the fact that legislators in Virginia have recently tried to close all the clinics in the state because they put in place these, like, really draconian new rules about the physical plant, or sort of the physical office in which the abortions can take place, that, you know, are threatening to close all the clinic providers, or all the providers in the state. And so if we look around the country, and there had, like, 2011 was a record year in terms of the number of anti-abortion laws that passed in states. But it's not just about the number, it's about the layering of those bills. And so we've really sort of made a point as every time there's a new bill introduced, sort of going through and showing how that is related to other things that have already happened in the state. And so it's not just about one new hurdle for women who are seeking abortions or doctors who want to provide them. It's sort of about, these are the compounding effect of 20-week bans and waiting periods and ultrasounds and sort of pre-mandated scripts about what the doctors have to tell the woman a lot of times, which contain really false information. And so I think it's sort of what we were able to do is to provide that context, which actually sort of helps people understand, you know, really that this war is not about a bunch of little tiny, you know, it's a bunch of tiny attacks that really do add up to a really sort of big picture attack on reproductive rights in the U.S.
And that oftentimes some of these attacks are coordinated across state lines and with the same kind of inspiration and or funding from folks like Americans United for Life. Is that correct?
Right, exactly. A lot of these are, you know, there's pretty major anti-abortion groups at the federal level who are basically just writing model bills and handing them to legislators around the country. You know, they actually get a pre-written bill that they just sort of can, you know, fill in the blanks and offer it in their legislature. And so we really are able to sort of connect the dots and say, well, this really bad bill was introduced in South Dakota, but then it was introduced in Nebraska, and then it was introduced in another state, which really does highlight that a lot of these aren't sort of grassroots state efforts. They're federal groups that are sort of coming in and you know, telling lawmakers what to do.
So I'm going to just ask folks to speak up, raise your hand, ask some questions if we have any callers on the line who would like to ask Kate or myself a question.
Remember to press star 9.
Oh, sorry. Press star 9. That's how you do it.
Oh, it's Diane again. Kate, how are you seeing the Obama campaign shaping up vis-a-vis all this current information that's just so draconian and so shocking? Do you interface with people from the campaign, or I mean, in any way, or do you have any sense of how he's going to be shaping this messaging during his campaign?
I don't actually interface with campaign people that often. I tend to talk more to sort of their policy people here in Washington than I do with the campaign.
That's what I meant, the policy people.
Yeah, I talk to the policy people more, which has been interesting. I was at an off-the-record briefing over at the White House a few months ago, and actually the most interesting thing for me at that briefing was there with several of his top advisors on women and health issues. And they actually seemed that they were really surprised by a lot of the attacks from the right wing. I mean, I didn't take them as being sort of insincere in that. I actually think they were surprised, especially by the contraception mandate. It sounds like they really thought that they weren't going to have quite the backlash that they did. It's been interesting to watch how they handle that. I think they've actually handled the outrage as well as they can on contraception. But they really aren't out there sort of owning it and saying, like, this is something that we absolutely think was right. They kind of backed off and are avoiding talking about it, which,
really?
I'm not a political strategist. I'm not actually sure what the best approach for them would be.
Yeah.
But it's not something I hear them talking about, a lot. I think the campaign will probably continue talking about.
That's where the interface between the campaign and the policy people connect, because the campaign people have to figure out, they get the information from the policy people, and then they have to figure out how to frame it.
Yeah.
Well, and I think also that you know, kind of proxy groups, certainly groups like Emily's List that are, have been very forthright and sort of saying how much our reporting has kind of, often energized campaigns that they were working on or, brought new things to light that they could then go kind of organize around.
Exactly. Yeah, great. Excellent.
Claire, it looks like we have another caller.
Okay. Somebody on the line that's been...
This is Kim Keller.
Hey, Kim.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
I was just wondering what the sort of, if there was any space for the medical community and where they fit into this discussion, because they seem like they're potentially affected by these laws as well. And if that's, if the American Medical Association is a part of the dialogue at all.
That's a good question. I mean, I think historically the AMA has steered clear of this debate, but Kate, there certainly are groups that are smaller groups that are speak up about what this is doing to their sort of ability to practice. But there's been a real drain of people who will go into certainly abortion services because of the attacks on them. But Kate, maybe you have a little bit more to say on what's going on currently.
Yeah, I hear a lot from the groups that represent abortion providers, like the National Abortion Federation or Physicians for Reproductive Health and Choice. I hear a lot from them, and they've been very vocal and out front in confronting a lot of these attacks on women around the country, and also talking about why the healthcare mandate for contraception coverage is really important to them. So we see them. I haven't seen as much from sort of the bigger national groups like AMA. My impression is that they tend to avoid things that are somewhat controversial. I hear from them on other issues, particularly environmental health, regularly, but not necessarily on contraception or abortion coverage.
I mean, as we've seen over the past 20 years, there's been a real decline in the number of people kind of willing to go into abortion services, and or if they are willing, there's just fewer and fewer medical schools who will train in this regard whatsoever. So it's part of the reason why you see in states like Mississippi and I guess now Nebraska, where there's one remaining abortion service provider, if any.
Right. Actually, another piece of our area coverage that I'm pretty proud of is that we are covering also sort of what this means for doctors and for women. We had a story a few months ago about an abortion provider in Kansas who, she was an assistant to Dr. George Tiller, who was killed two years ago now, for providing later term abortions. And he was one of the few people in the country that actually provided them. Now the Kansas Health Board is going after one of his associates and basically is going to take away her medical license because of her relationship with Tiller and because she was out there providing care to women who really needed it, later term abortions, for a variety of reasons. And so we did a profile of her a few months ago, did a piece on another later term abortion provider who's in the DC area and sort of attempts to really put a whole lot of anti-abortion activism attention on his clinic here. And so I think that's another important area, because I think people don't realize how hard it is for providers and how few of them there are these days. I mean, there are a lot of states where they have to fly in a provider from out of state and they don't have anyone at all on a regular basis who can provide those services.
It was interesting. We years ago, we had published a memoir of a woman who went through fairly horrific attempt to find an abortion provider before Roe, and we put that up a few months ago. It'd been years, and it wasn't pre-internet, but it was sort of pre-social media when it had been published, and it just took off, and was hundreds of thousands of people, I think, read it and retweeted and Facebooked it and that kind of a thing. And it just goes to show that I think one of the things that's happening is that, A, that women, and men who weren't, around kind of pre-Roe don't remember what it was like. And I think the other thing that it highlighted was kind of very well was that, in states where there's no access to abortion providers, or if they figure out a way to ban abortions even when, the fetus is going to die or the mother's health is at risk after 20 weeks, that will, even more than exists now, lead to a sort of two-tiered system where women with means will be able to find a provider in another state or even another country if it comes to that. But that, for a lot of women, there's part of the reason they end up having an abortion is that they didn't have access to contraception and decent medical care to begin with. So it really is, it's really a holistic approach that we're taking. I just want to see if there are any more questions. And if not, we can let everyone go. And thank you so much for being here. Lauren, do we have anyone else who might want to
It looks like we don't have any other further questions. So with that, we will end the call. Thank you, everyone, for taking the time to be with us today. We're going to do one more call again toward the fall that will feature David Corn and will be focused on the election. So stay tuned for that when we have the exact date. And we welcome your feedback to make these calls better for you. You know, you've been supporting us for many years and generously. So we want to make sure these are effective and informative and interesting. So Stephanie will be sending around an email once the call wraps, giving you a chance to ask any questions you might not have been able to do today and to offer any advice or suggestions for how we can improve for subsequent calls. With that, I will say thanks to Clara and Kate for being here and doing stellar reporting. And we look forward to hearing you on the next call.
Thanks, everyone.